LGIM Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome to LGIM Talks, our investment commentary podcast. A company's success or failure is largely determined by the quality of its leaders' decision-making. And this is why the makeup of that leadership team is so crucial. Here to talk more about how diversity can lead to company and therefore investor success is Head of Corporate Governance North America, Claire Payne. Claire, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Hi, Mark. Nice to be here.
For the benefit of our listeners who might not be so au fait with all the jargon that we use, what at the very basic level, what is corporate governance?
So corporate governance is the ability to hold the companies that we invest in to account as a broad investor. And that would be to account on various issues, environmental issues, social issues and governance issues.
And what's your role within the team?
My role within the team, I head up the stewardship of diversity. Mm-hmm. So I kind of lead putting our voting policy together for diversity and engaging with companies.
Perfect. So you're engaging with these companies, meeting with these leadership teams to help them become better for the benefit of both them and our investors as well.
Yeah, and broader society as a wider stakeholder.
So, Claire, why is diversity important for companies?
Following on from the financial crisis in 2008, there was a review done called the Walker Review of the banking industry, because it was felt that a contributor to the financial crisis was that boards were actually made up of people that looked very similar. And there was an element of groupthink in terms of decision-making, which actually was a massive risk. So the Walker Review pointed out that this groupthink was a risk to investors and, you know, how we can address that. And one of the elements that came out of that was, you know, looking at the diversity of these leadership teams, whether that's boards of companies mm-hmm. or executives. Teams. So it actually became a key area as investors that we wanted to start to focus on to ensure that these leadership teams are successful.
I mean, I guess if you've got these people around a table, all who have the same background or who have the same outlook of life, I mean, they're all the same gender or the same ethnicity, they're coming at the problem from very much the same direction.
Exactly.
So it kind of does stand to reason that a more diverse team does lead to better decisions. Is that something you've seen play out in any research?
Yes, I mean, it is intuitive to us as a society, I think, but certainly the research, the empirical research has been coming out now for the last sort of six years or so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, McKinsey and Credit Suisse have both produced empirical research that actually shows a correlation between higher performance and better diverse teams. And there's also actually the other way around in terms of, you know, the question around performance and diverse teams, whether those are actually linked. And even if performance is similar, actually a lot of the time less diverse teams, actually they do actually lag their peers that have better diverse leadership.
So not only is there this kind of performance benefit to companies, there also seems to be this intangible brand and reputation benefit for being a more diverse company that people, prospective employees, look at you as a more attractive place to work.
Yeah, certainly. I think companies are recognising now that being better in terms of diversity in its broadest sense is actually appealing to prospective employees and current employees, and that they're actually more connected to their customer. I mean, you know, 70% of purchasing power is made by women. So actually, if you don't have diverse leadership teams in terms of gender, at least, then you're actually missing a bit of a trick. You know, you're not actually going to be staying on top of the latest trends.
Well, so it kind of, again, I mean, it seems like there's such an obvious point that why is this not a top priority for companies? I mean, I was watching you at a recent presentation you did for members of the boards of various UK companies, mm-hmm. and you presented one slide and it had all of these quotes from CEOs and chairs of boards, which were quite cringeworthy. I mean, astounding to say the least. Which one was like, I don't think women fit comfortably into the board environment. One was, we already have one woman, so we are done. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, these are reasons that are coming from some of our very senior leadership teams in FTSE 350 companies. So yes, it is actually really shocking. And I think my favourite was that shareholders just don't ask us about this, which if you see the progress that has been made and actually the continued push and debate from investors on this issue. I mean, I co-chaired the 30% Club Investor Group, which now has 32 members and combined assets under management of £11 trillion. I mean, you know, that's a really big number
that's
and power. It's not insignificant.
Not at all. So I'm so glad you brought up the market improvements. And I think over in just the last few weeks, the FTSE 100, the 100 largest companies in the UK, saw over 30% board representation of women on their boards. I mean, are things moving in the right direction?
Yeah, they absolutely are. And I think we need to stay positive because the data has improved since 2011 when the Davies report came out with the 25% target, which has now been pushed up by the Hampton-Alexander report up to 33%. We've absolutely seen progress in both the FTSE 100 and the 250. And you're right in saying that a few weeks ago, the FTSE 100 reached the 30% on average, of women on boards. And again, you know, we are looking at this as the minimum, but progress is certainly being made and it continues to be made. The FTSE 250, a little slower progress, but we would generally expect that because they are slightly smaller boards and they've currently just hit 25%.
So that's still a positive picture at board level. Could I ask a bit more about, I mean, executive level? So this is the chief executive, the chief financial officer, that kind of very senior decision making within a company, but not quite the board, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, so yes, the executive level has struggled to improve, and we have actually seen a bit of a drop off in executive representation, certainly in the FTSE 100, which is a little bit concerning because as much as the board numbers are looking good, the non-executive numbers are looking good, these are not the decision-making roles. The decision-making roles within a company are the executive team, and whether that's the CEO and then the direct reports to the CEO. So without progress in this area, you know, we are still seeing a limited number of women in those decision-making roles. Although that has stagnated somewhat, I think now the extra focus on this and the data now coming out on this is a real reminder that actually this executive part of the pipeline is critical.
So you mentioned the word pipeline, which is so important to me, to this issue, I think, is that you create this strong pipeline of more diverse leadership coming up through, say, senior management into the executive level who would then go on to become board members. And it seems to be that the UK has improved at the board level, but it's kind of lacked that pipeline. Would you say that the pipeline's improving, or is it still needs a lot more work?
I think the pipeline is improving. Companies are generally pretty much half and half in terms of gender at the lower levels of, you know, the general employee base. But yes, there is. We do still see that drop off of women at those more senior levels. And really that comes down to an organisation's policies and how they are implementing those policies. So there's one thing to have diversity in a company, but there's another thing to have inclusivity within a company. So you can have diversity, but without the right policies and processes in place, then you're not going to retain that diverse talent.
Exactly. So you as you absolutely said, so a company might employ in its general workforce half and half, but if the only people who are getting promoted are the men, you end up with a very undiverse leadership team.
Exactly. And that's when you get the pyramid shape and the drop off at the top, which is what we need to address.
Is this the same picture internationally speaking? I know you've mentioned France and Germany before. What's the view from overseas?
Yeah, I think it is a similar picture, actually, despite the fact that the countries you mentioned, you know, France, Germany, Sweden, they do actually have quotas in terms of non-executive director representation. And those quotas were put in place believing that would actually mean that progress would be made and that would solve the problem, essentially. And it may have done at non-executive level, but if you look at the executive numbers in those countries, they're pretty shocking. They hang around sort of 2-3%, which
is... they've met the quota level for the board, but they've not actually taken the spirit with which the quotas were in place in full.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a box-ticking exercise in Europe where that's only going to fix that certain level, you know, when we're talking about fixing, but it's not actually you know, addressing the real root cause of the problem.
So I guess this takes me on to kind of back to our very first question of what is corporate governance? Well, the raison d'etre for corporate governance is to affect this change, to make situations better for companies, for investors. So you've described this as a four-stage process with engagement with companies, collaboration, public policy and voting. So if I could start with your kind of company engagement, you've mentioned the promotion pipeline. How can companies embed a commitment to diversity and inclusivity into a company's culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. I think it's a question that companies are still getting their arms around a little bit and still addressing. And I think it's more than just actually having a diversity policy in their disclosures. It's actually about having a diversity strategy. And those two things are actually quite different. And, you know, in terms of our engagement with the companies, it's not up to us as an investor to tell them what that should look like.
No, it's a bit finger waggy, isn't it?
It is. You know, you've got to be careful about micromanaging a company, which is not our job. But our job is to hopefully share best practice, share experience, share ideas that we're getting from other companies that are doing well in this space.
Because there are companies that are doing very well?
Yeah, there are. You know, there are companies that are really showing us what they are doing in terms of diversity through their disclosures. It's not just a boilerplate exercise and a boilerplate statement of, we believe diversity is important, full stop. You know, that doesn't give us the kind of background of what value do you think this will bring to your company, which is what we're looking for. So it is, and it's not a silver bullet. There's not one thing that's going to fix this. It is lots of different things that will work in conjunction with each other that will hopefully push things forward.
Would it include kind of policies, not only just a verbal commitment and demonstrating leadership from the top, but like implementing policies such as better parental leave, work-life balance. Are those sort of things you would see as contributing towards a more inclusive environment at a company?
Yeah, absolutely. Because my previous point that if you're going to be wanting to, you know, recruit more diverse talent, and we need more diverse talent to be better, then you've got to embrace the needs of that diverse talent. And absolutely right. You know, you're looking at maternity policies, shared parental leave policies, and, you know, all these different policies that you need to ensure are working, flexible working policies, for instance. So all of these things will work in conjunction, yes.
So, I mean, that's the wonderfully positive side. I mean, recently in the UK, as of last year, the gender pay gap was mandated that all companies had to publish their gender pay gap. And you learned a lot of surprising things about companies who you actually quite surprised by, where you wouldn't have expected a pay gap of quite the size. And the UK has the largest gender pay gap in Europe, which is not a award I was particularly hoping we'd win. But, you know, what's the correlation between better representation and lower gender pay gap?
Yeah, and there is a correlation there. You know, when we're looking now at diversity going forward, the gender pay gap metric is an important metric for us to be looking at, because there is a correlation between a wider gap and, you know, worse diversity within a company, essentially. And it's pure and simple about the gender pay gap is purely about there's not enough women at the top levels of the company, which is exactly what we've been talking about up until now. You know, there's not enough women at that executive level. The non-executive directors, you know, that's the board level, but that's not within the company. They're independent from the company. They're not actually
Employees. Not dictating
exactly
strategy.
That's the oversight element. But, you know, the women coming through to executive level, that's the top echelons that we want to get women into, and that will then help that gender pay gap close.
Is the issue there a recruitment problem? I mean, we've talked about pipeline, but, you know, a lot of people get hired into these these top level roles from outside of the company. I know you wrote an essay in conjunction with Spencer Stewart a number of years ago on the importance of making sure your headhunter understands that you are serious about diversity. How can recruitment be improved to leverage the importance of diversity?
Yeah, I think recruitment is a really key part of what we're talking about. And we are pushing companies to think about who they're using for recruitment, the executive search firms that they use. We've done work with executive search firms in the past to learn how they are looking for talent, because actually it's very easy for an executive search firm to say to a company that's using them, you know, sorry, we can't find any of the diverse talent. But then it's on the onus on the company to say, no, go back, look in the different pools, because it is harder to look in those newer pools. We know this.
So newer pools, you mean kind of outside
of the kind of, you know, the network that may already be known. You know, there's charities, the not-for-profit organisations.
Public sector.
Yeah, you know, all of these different sectors. There's really extremely talented and senior women in these areas that are not being looked at because they're slightly outside of the normal network, if you like.
This seems like a really good counter towards the excuse, to go back to those awful quotes from earlier, there just aren't enough candidates excuse. I mean, we've tried looking, but we couldn't find anyone there, therefore we're done.
Yeah. And you know, that's not a reason that we would accept, knowing, you know, the pool of women out there that are looking for executive roles. And you've got to be also thinking about, it goes back to the pipeline question again, you've got to be thinking about nurturing your talent internally. And it's you know, at non-executive level, yes, you know, you bring people in from the outside because they need to be independent. There's a huge pool of non-executive women out there. But in terms of executive women, you know, you've got to be nurturing that internally and actually developing their careers so that they're ready to take on those senior roles. So, you know, we would go back to a company and say, where are you looking for your talent? Are you using your networks effectively? Because there is talent out there and it's ready to be used.
There was a wonderful piece of research which I actually did a lot of work on when I was studying gender politics at university, which was men were promoted on the expectation that they would grow into and succeed in these roles, whereas women were promoted only when they have proven that they could already have done the role before. And yet it's so much harder to prove that you've done the role of a CFO or a CEO. And therefore, is that a contributing factor to this lack of pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It's a really important point that you bring up. It's the performance versus potential question. And I think that is a stumbling block. And it's about companies thinking differently around who they are wanting to be on their teams and about taking risks in essentially. And it's not that these people, you know, we're not expecting companies to look at people that are not qualified, that don't have the merit. That's absolutely not what we're saying, because there's a huge pool of talent in terms of merit out there. But, you know, take a risk. So in terms of non-executive directors, if we go back to that, you know, we say to companies, do you need everyone on the board to have previous CEO experience? And I think a long time ago that would have been the case. But now companies are feeling much more comfortable, and us as a large shareholder are supportive of a company, you know, bringing people in as non-executives that don't have that previous experience, because there is a boardroom table that's a huge amount of experience, you know, previous CEO experience that can be brought.
That can be leveraged.
Yeah, exactly.
When you raise the issue of diversity with companies, what's the biggest pushback you receive on the issue?
It's actually in terms of merit. So companies often respond and say, well, we appoint on merit. Mm-hmm. And we say, well, absolutely, we wouldn't expect you to not appoint on merit. But the next question for me is, you know, what's your definition of merit? Mm-hmm. And it's about broadening that definition of merit, and the best person for the team is actually what we're thinking about. And actually, you're more likely to appoint on merit if you look at a more diverse pool of talent.
Explain to me a bit more about that.
Well, it's essentially you know, we're thinking now in terms of merit. You know, is it specific skills? What does that,
experience?
And that's absolutely right. But you've got to be looking at that person and what they're going to add to the team that you are putting them into. And whether that's a board or whether that's an executive team or another leadership team, then that can actually make you think about merit in a very different way.
It's almost like finding a missing jigsaw puzzle piece, or like looking at your team now, what is missing from this team, or what experience or outlook is
exactly
missing?
What's the best person for your team? And that's not just in terms of skill sets, but it's in terms of, you know, leadership skills, negotiation skills, all those sort of things.
That takes me on to your second part of driving change, which is the collaboration aspect of it's good that we, as a large shareholder and a manager of steward of a lot of index assets on behalf of our clients, can say these things, but I think it's made all the more powerful when we collaborate with other investors. I mean, you mentioned earlier the 30% Club investor group, and this is a group of investors, asset managers, as you said, with $11 trillion assets under management. there are also other things of which we are part of, like the Women in Finance Charter. Can you tell us a bit more about these things?
Yeah, so we are also signed up to the Women in Finance Charter, and that's actually a commitment to, you know, progress women through our business and ensuring that diversity targets, etc., are linked to remuneration internally. Also, the Diversity Project is something that we're involved with, and our CEO is an executive sponsor of that. And we also, as well as the 30% Club Investor Group that you mentioned in the UK and the US, we also collaborate at the moment with other asset owners on diversity on boards in the US. And actually, that's also linked to board tenure in the US as well.
So you talked about Women in Finance Charter, and that seems to me a very good example of a sector-specific response to these challenges, because, of course, not every company is the same. When it's been manufacturing, finance, agriculture, could you tell us a little bit more about how various sectors are employing really good ways to deal with the issues that are more specific to them?
Yeah, sure. And you're absolutely right in terms of, you know, the different sectors do have their own challenges. And within our work on the 30% Club Investor Group, we've actually come across a sector initiative called the Real Estate Balance, which is led by the real estate sector. And they have come out with actually a toolkit that can be used, not actually just for the real estate sector, but actually for any company. And they've made that huge resource. And it's in terms of research and, you know, reports, etc., and things that companies can do to address these challenges. And they've made that available on their website to any company that wants to look at it, which I think is fantastic.
I mean, that is best practice right there and then.
It's brilliant, and it's brilliant. But it's also in terms of a sector owning their own challenges and actually, you know, galvanising that support within that sector to really help that sector move forward. And there's also Powerful Women as well, which is in the energy sector.
Okay. Well, that's a great name.
It's a great name, yeah.
I heard one.
So we're hoping that, you know, more sectors are going to be thinking about what they can do to really push their own agenda forward in terms of this.
Because I imagine that a change can be affected in a much more effective manner.
Yeah, more long-term.
Yeah,
as well.
If it's actually applicable to those companies rather than, say, top-down, every company in the UK has to have a quota, for instance.
Yeah.
Which does take me on to the public policy aspect. I mean, do quotas work?
Well, going back to our previous conversation briefly around the some countries in the EU, we don't think they do.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't support quotas when there was a push for that from the government, which is then why the Davies report came out initially with the targets set. Mm. So we're much more of a believer in aspirational targets, quite simply because, you know, companies will be in different places. So it's not up to us either as an investor to say this should be your aspirational target. It's about asking a company, you know, think about where you're at now, think about where you want to be in 10, 20, 30 years time, and put targets in place, much like you would for financial targets, that will help you get there. Because basically what gets measured gets managed. It's quite as simple as that. But quotas will be much more, you know, at that top just board level, which, as we've seen in Europe, in some countries in Europe, is not working for the executive pipeline.
It goes back to that. We've met our quota, then
done.
We're done.
Yeah, and that's not what we want to see.
It hasn't solved the underlying
change. Yeah.
Of course. I guess the most recent target set by the government for the Hampton Alexander is the 33% of women on FTSE 350 boards by 2020.
Yeah.
And I believe that's our target as well?
It is, yes. It is a little bit confusing because, you know, there's the 30% sort of main target that's there, but essentially, you know, it's the same target. And that is purely really based on the idea of, you know, critical mass, that actually 30% is seen as a critical mass. So when that is reached, that sustainable change is then almost self-perpetuating. But that is, again, a minimum. You know, ideally, gender parity is 50-50. It's giving that demographic a voice. And don't forget, you know, women are not a minority.
No, not at all. So that takes me on to our last lever for affecting change, and this is voting, and this is where our targets as LGIM come into play. So I'm going to take it back to the simplest issue. What is voting? How can we use voting, what does voting mean as an investor?
Well, it's a really important tool for us because, you know, when you own a company, when you own the equity of a company, you have a voice, essentially, mm-hmm. and that voice is translated into votes on behalf of our clients.
And that's at their annual general meeting?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the annual general meeting of a company. And we started to vote on this issue back in 2015, mm-hmm. Where we started to vote in the UK against all male boards. And that voting policy has actually now evolved into 2018, where we vote against FTSE 350 companies where there's not 25% female representation at board level.
Okay, so that's voting against the re-election of the board chair.
Is that correct?
Is that my understanding?
That's correct. Yeah.
And that was for companies that had no women on their boards whatsoever.
Yes, that was back in 2015, which back then, you know, felt pretty punchy.
I mean, it was only 3 years.
It was only 3 years ago. Yes, but if you know, we've got to remember that in 2011, the Davies report came out for 25% as minimum representation by 2015.
Okay.
And so that's why we brought that in, because actually many companies were still not reaching that target.
Well, if they saw it as a target which had no kind of
real teeth.
Yeah.
Which is why we take our voting very seriously and have put these policies in place, because we really do feel it is making that change.
I guess that's where us being part of these reviews is really helpful, because we can help say to the government, this is the right way to go about it, and this is how we as stewards of investments will try and affect that change.
Yeah, and stewardship is about engagement, but also that really important part is voting, mm-hmm. because voting against a chair, you know, it's a very personal thing.
I imagine they see it quite personally, as they'll come meet with us and imagine they'll be quite annoyed.
They want to then understand, and even if they do know what our policy is, they want to understand further why that vote against has been applied. And therefore, it gives us ability to have that more in-depth conversation just on this specific subject, which is so important.
Of course.
And they can understand then how we're thinking about this and realising that, yes, it is really important to us and we're going to continue to vote in this way.
It goes back to your first quote of, our shareholders don't care about this.
No, we do.
We very careful. We very clearly do. That's the UK, and I know you've mentioned that we're going global with our voting policy. So could you talk a bit more how we're applying our diversity standards internationally?
Yeah, sure. Well, 2017 was the first year we started to vote against all male boards in the US.
Of which there are a few more, fewer than in the UK?
There were a fair amount in the US. Mm-hmm. Yeah, still what we would, you know, think too many.
Yeah.
And we wanted to really apply what we'd learnt in the UK to the US, while taking into account that, you know, the US is a different beast. Mm-hmm. And we do look at our voting policies and putting those in place with that lens. That regional lens, and we have to be sensitive to that. But, you know, we really now feel that no corporate boards should have, you know, no women on the board. We don't really feel that's acceptable. So that's why we brought in making this now a global policy. Mm-hmm. And then last year we started to vote against companies in other markets where they have all male boards.
Wow. So, to wrap this up, I know this engaging companies and telling them to be better must at times not be the most enjoyable job of the world. So I would like to ask you, what's making you happy in markets now?
Well, I think what's making me happy is that the FTSE 100 has got to 30% on average. There's still a long way to go, but I'm very excited by that.
And it's a good target to have met, and ahead of target, considering UK companies didn't quite meet the 25% by 2015. To meet the 30% by 2020 is good to see.
It is. Let's hope we get to 40% by 2020.
We'll record another podcast for that one.
Let's
as well.
Do it.
So to conclude, what I feel like I've taken away from our conversation here is that it's really a lot about turning diversity policies into diversity strategies, creating these concrete proposals for improving representation in companies across all levels. Would you say that's about correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely it. And companies do have to think about this as a strategy and linking, you know, this is not separate. Diversity and culture is not separate from a strategy of a business in terms of, you know, what it's trying to achieve as a business. The two go together. The two can't be separated.
No, of course. I mean, so often companies say our employees are our most important asset.
Exactly.
So we want to see the proof.
Exactly.
So thank you so much, Claire, for joining us today to talk more about diversity.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And to read more about Claire's views, we have the article The Importance of Gender Diversity published on our website, where you can also see where we've scored the UK's companies on their levels of gender diversity. Thank you very much to Claire for joining us. Thanks to our wonderful production team. Thanks to our wonderful producer, Holly McNulty. And thanks to you. See you next week. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.